Hello. How are you? How you feeling today? All right. I know, it's Friday. Normally episodes come out on Thursday, and it's Friday. Bottom line is I forgot to record the intro and outro on Wednesday, so I was like, and I went through most of Thursday working, and I realized, you know what I didn't do? I didn't do the podcast. So here we are. And lots of stuff happened this week. There's a lot of stuff in the news, but here's the thing is this conversation today with my guest, it's special. This is something different. This is a different tone than we normally have on the show. I mean, it's not so different, but it's a different energy. It's a different vibe. And as I was thinking about what I wanted to do for the intro of this episode and what I wanted to talk about and what I should cover and what segments might be a good idea, should we do a bad take brigade, should I give my thoughts on the breakdown of what happened in the midterm elections, all this stuff, I just thought, I don't think it just doesn't flow with the energy that my guest today brought to the show. It's a good conversation. It's a healthy conversation. It's a conversation I'm excited to bring to you, but it's a conversation I don't want to muddy up with an overly heated intro. I don't want to get caught up or carried away in the intro. I want to keep the energy here pure. So let's do that this week, all right? Nice and simple, okay? Let's all take a deep breath in. Wherever we are, wherever you are, if you're walking, if you're in the car, wherever you are, let's take a moment, pause, center yourself, bring yourself into the present, take a deep breath in, deep breath out, deep breath out. That doesn't make any sense. You know what I'm saying? I'd be the worst meditation guide. Deep breath out. That doesn't make any sense. Blah, 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 blah. This is my meditation guide, as I'm just really bad at. Breathe. Give yourself an exhale, release on the exhale, and just bring it in and center yourself, because we've got a really cool, good conversation with a really cool guest today, all right? My guest today is an author who has written several books, has a new book out right now. It is called Untangled, Walking the Eightfold Path to Clarity, Courage, and Compassion. And it was written by my guest, Sensei Koshin Pele Ellison. So without any further ado, without much aplomb at the top of the show, let's just get into it, shall we? From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I am talking with Sensei Koshin Pele Ellison about the spiritual process of untangling. Hello, YouTube. Hello, Spotify. Hello, everybody. We're back with another episode of People Pleaser, and I'm very excited for our guest today. Very excited for you to hear from our guest today. Today, I am joined by Koshin Pele Ellison, Sensei Koshin Pele Ellison. Koshin, how are you today?
I'm doing great. It's wonderful to see you.
It's wonderful to see you as well. I'm so excited to chat with you. How did you come into the life that you are currently living? I kind of want to know a little bit about, like, where are you from, and what is your background, and what's your story that leads you to today here speaking with me?
Well, it's there's so many places to think about origins, right? And I often think about origins in terms of my great-grandparents, and thinking about, I come from a lineage of people from Eastern Europe, from both Ukraine and Hungary and Poland, and they were the few people in their families who thought when things were getting bad that we have to get out of here.
And yeah.
Jewish people living in a place where anti-Semitism, which is also, of course, arising again in this country at this time. And they were kind of the crazy ones. Like, all the rest of the people in their family thought they were crazy. They're like, that's not going to happen here. That's not going to happen. And they just trusted that there was something really off about this and dangerous. And so I also feel that I come from these kind of courageous, intuitive people who said, pay attention. And so I often, you know, in my days, feel them and feel their presence with me. And so I grew up in this kind of milieu of kind of immigrant post-Holocaust, when a lot of those kind of families of migrant families or immigrant families that there's tends to, where there's lots of trauma, like most of the family, the extended family were killed. And there is that trauma really nestles into families. And so it's quite powerful. And so I grew up in that kind of family with people with deep values and deeply caring and socially minded and interested in social healing as I am. And yet their capacity to match those values with how they were functioning in a day-to-day way, there often was a big chasm or a big gap. And so I come from that kind of background where beautiful, beautiful people with beautiful values who not always were functioning in the most kind or compassionate and loving way. And so I grew up, my father and my parents grew up in New York City. And during the war on poverty, my father, which is Lyndon Johnson, which was a president, and he had this war on poverty, and my father got one of these fellowships to be a fellow on the war on poverty, and they moved him to Syracuse, New York, and he didn't know where that was. And so they moved upstate New York, and I was born there in an elevator.
Wow, born in an elevator in Syracuse, New York. I really like the way that you establish the story as saying, I like to think about my grandparents and sort of my lineage and sort of the lineage of the line of trauma. This is a thought that I've been thinking recently in my life about. A big part of this year for me, and I've been talking about this on my podcast a lot, is like coming to terms with impermanence. And in that vein is coming to terms with my own fear of death and things like that, just the fear of my own impermanence of my life, not knowing what happens after death, stuff like this. And a thought that I've had recently is that impermanence is incredibly natural. It is the natural state of things to always be in motion and always be in flux and always be shifting. And in that regard, a permanent death doesn't make sense to me. Like to die and then that's it, that's the end of you, there is nothing that carries on for you, that doesn't make sense. And we actually know this because we carry generational trauma baked into our DNA from our ancestors. So for you to talk about like this this lineage of intuitive people, intuitive thinkers that you carry, that's in you, we all know this, we all know about hereditary traits and things like this, but this is literally people who came before us, their life actually carrying on. And I've been kind of reframing death in my mind as like, it's nothing but a transformation. It's nothing but a continuation of the natural process of impermanence, of the natural process of things constantly being in flux. But it's not an end point. It's not where a person ends, because those people are in you as my ancestors are in me, you know?
Right. It's amazing, you know, to really reflect on that, you know, for many years, I actually, before writing this book, I really thought about kind of the epigenetic trauma and the kind of focused on that. And then it was through writing this, which is the book is really tracing how do we go from being tangled and suffering and really in the heart of our own confusion and overwhelm to how do we actually find freedom? In an actual way. And it's really the prescription of the historical Buddha, who really saw how do you move from suffering to freedom, to liberation. in an actually ordinary way with wonder and joy. And it was through that writing and that kind of interrogation of my own mind and my own patterns, I began to realize, like, wait a second, I've been kind of looking at even my own ancestors and my own story in a very kind of limited way. And I realized, like, wait a second, these people also were amazing. They were deeply listening and looking and were interested in survival and thriving and courageous to, you know, some of the stories of how they escaped those countries is just, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. And they are one and dozens of millions of beings who have done the same. And so I feel like, wow, we're also the coming from a generation of this kind of this very basic living desire to thrive and to continue. And it's kind of like that even the dinosaurs apparently would kind of go at great distances to, you know, find water, you know, like that there's something in our just living beingness that is drawing us to life itself, if we listen.
Yes, yes. And,
but I think that the one of the things that's so important is that if we just stay in the tangle and we stay in our overwhelm, it's really hard to see. Because literally, if we just stay in the anxiety and the fear and the hunched overness, it's really hard to open your shoulders and be like, what else is true here? Mm-hmm. What else can I do here? How can I meet you with some loving tenderness?
Yes, yes. I want to talk a lot about your book that you've written, Untangled, Walking the Eightfold Path to Clarity, Courage, and Compassion, and talking about this process that you've already sort of begun to introduce of being tangled in your own ego, your own story, your own you-ness, and how to become untangled. And I want to get more into that. But before we do that, I want to hear a little bit more about how we set up the lineage, the heritage, the grandparents, the, you know, these people who fled these, overwhelming circumstances. And we find you being born in an elevator in Syracuse, New York. How do you get from there to, walking a Zen path and finding the path to healing that you're on now?
To me, like, this is the, you know, in some ways, the eternal question, you know, how do we get here? It's such a beautiful question, you know, to really for all of us to think about, like, how did I get here? And what's the story I'm telling myself about how I got here? And is that really true? You know, because we narrate ourselves and curate ourselves very well. And So there from the elevator, I apparently left the elevator, and I grew up in a family where there was a lot of chaos and a lot of good things. So there was a lot of like these like incredible values and incredible social advocacy and doing beautiful work. And my mother was even involved with like the beginning of the National Organization of Women and like all of these different things, these very beautiful causes for social healing. And at the same time, there was in my parents divorced, and in particular in one of the homes, there was just like a lot of violence. There was a lot of physical violence and sexual violence and outwardly super successful, upwardly moving, living in a nice kind of situation. And so it appeared well, but it actually, what was happening inside didn't feel safe and didn't feel okay. Mm-hmm. And as a young gay kid, you know, like I really felt you know, was already getting bullied at a young age for that, particularly like starting in like sixth grade. And
so there's violence at home and violence at school.
It was like this crazy gauntlet of just kind of like, oh, like nowhere that felt particularly safe. But I do remember a really important, there were moments though of life-giving deep meaning. And one was like my grandfather and grandmother lived in, my mom's parents lived in Newport Beach, and I used to go there a couple times a year. And I just remember my grandfather used to save those National Geographic magazines, and we would lay on their white shag carpet next to like the white leather beanbag. You know, it's like it was the '70s, and we would just flip through the magazines and having a sense of wonder. And he just loved seeing the world and what else is true. Mm-hmm. And he's like, did you ever imagine that was happening in that country? And did you ever imagine that? And he really was this spark of imagination. And I remember at that time, there were like lost native tribes that would keep finding these lost native tribes back in the day. And every once in a while, they would have a profile of a city. And it was like, whoa, look at this city. And there was one of Tokyo. And I remember flipping this one page and seeing this picture of this monk and wearing this Arigasa hat, and which is that big round straw hat.
Yeah.
And you can really see their eyes. It has a slight smile, dressed in robes. And all the other people in the photograph were blurred. And wow, you know? And I just remember like then looking at like, well, what is that? And underneath the caption, it says, Zen Buddhist monk in Tokyo.
Mm.
And I remember feeling very clear. I said, Grandpa, I want to be that.
Wow.
And I remember going home and telling my mom, when I grow up, I want to be a Zen Buddhist monk. Because I think in some ways it kind of makes sense in retrospect, you know, to that there was so much chaos. Everyone was kind of blurred in my life. And there was this somehow this capacity to see someone who could be still
mm-hmm.
and content in the midst of it. And I just felt this deep yearning for that. And so I actually began at that time, there was this movie, like a mini series and a book called Shogun that was like very popular. And, mm-hmm. and I remember just like trying to find all the Japanese words, trying to learn, teaching myself Japanese at 8 years old, you know, not very successful, but you know, there was a lot of enthusiasm because I felt like I had to, there was something about that culture that I felt had a key that could unlock a door. And so I really began pursuing, just kind of beginning to learn. And at that time too, there was this great confluence of things, you know, that there was this movie called Star Wars.
That yes. yeah.
And it was just an amazing, I remember my friend Jason Goldsmith and I were like, we saw it 27 times that when it opened, and we would just like bike on our little banana seat bikes and down to the mall and watch it
yeah.
again and again. And just the amazement of that character, Luke Skywalker, who's still around, you know, in these movies. And
mm-hmm.
and there's just like the poignancy of his like whininess in particular.
yeah.
That felt so relatable. It's like, he's like, oh, I want to be out of here. I don't want to be in this place. And just like feeling stuck. And
I got to go down to the, get the power converters at the, yeah. yeah. yeah.
Exactly. And I just felt like that's so relatable. And I love that his family also lived in a, like a hole.
Yeah.
I felt like I could relate to that too. I felt like that we were living in a hole.
Mm-hmm.
And he met this teacher. You could have a teacher. And I was like, wow, you can have a teacher? Like, not in like school, but like a teacher who actually teaches you about life. And I was like, wow, that seems somehow related. Mm-hmm. And I did appreciate, like, their outfits look a little like that monk,
you know? Yes, yes.
And I was like making some kind of connections. And then soon after that, that movie, The Karate Kid, the first one, came out. And that Mr. Miyagi, I was like, wow. Mm-hmm. There's a message again. And but also, like, Star Wars was still like a little abstract. Like, I don't know if I can go to another planet to find someone, even though I felt like I was from another planet. But Karate Kid was like this great, same, in some ways the same story. The kid's like very whiny and, you know, the same kind of arc in a certain way. And I realized you could learn karate. And maybe a karate teacher could actually help you. And I said, that's workable. Because at the local strip mall in the suburbs here, there was a karate school in the basement underneath the drugstore. So I went there, and this is when I was around 11. And the teacher was Sensei White. And I don't recall any children's classes per se. It was kind of like very kind of a very basic kind of place, and yeah, really stinky, and like they patched together a hardwood floor, and it smelled like, reeked of like probably mold and sweat. And yet he was so serious and committed, and it was very inspiring to be with this guy, this Sensei White. And he would have us sit on the wood floor, just like with our knees, you know, on our knees, with our feet under our butt, and just like, he would just have us sit there for about 20 minutes in stillness. And he said, you have to learn how to be still with your pain if you want to be free.
Wow.
And he would really slowly around all the people sitting, and we'd be sweating because it was so painful. And yet it felt like I was learning like superhero stuff, you know, that felt like, wow, this is very powerful. And it felt very connected to that monk, actually, like that. I realized that that must be what he knows how to do, how to be still with it all. And it was also mostly in retrospect, understanding that at that moment, something shifted with even all the perpetrators of harm. For me, I started to understand that they didn't know how to be still with their pain. They were so caught in their distraction, with their discomfort, with their, you know, anxiety, and people didn't know how to metabolize that, like most of us. Like, we're not really taught that. How do you just learn how to feel awkward, feel confused, feel tangled up, and not make it into a truth? Like, learning to feel suffering as opposed to I am suffering. And then we turn it into like what I often like to call a bad prophecy. Like, I am a victim. I am, you know, messed up. Because actually the reality is, what I learned there was, and continue to learn, is that, wow, I can be really hurting and okay. So yeah, when you learn how to sit with our pain, with our tangles, with our overwhelm, we start to find the softness. Like in meditation posture itself, you know, where we're really grounded, with our knees, with our hip bones, our sit bones, and really putting our breath in our lower belly, feeling that softness, feeling the uprightness of our own spine, and just opening our shoulders just a bit, even a millimeter. It's like that attitude is an attitude and a position of possibility. And I felt like that's what I was learning. To have these four points grounded and soft, upright and open, just felt like this incredible gift. It was like just being handed to you. And it's almost like the secret teaching of how to live a joyful life in the midst of what's hard, in the midst of what is heartbreaking, in the midst of our own devastation, that we can sit there and bear witness to it.
I love so much that this is something that you wanted to do from such a young age. I relate to that a lot. I love that you saw this photo of this monk in this National Geographic and went, what's that? I want to do that. And I also love that what you got from Star Wars was, oh, there's something about this Jedi way. There's something about, you know, coming from a place where you're just this whiny kid kicking dust and I got to go do my chores. But then you meet this grounded being that comes out and you know, he's wearing these robes and he seems to know something about presence and about stillness. And I mean, even the conclusion of that movie is like, breathe. Like he's in this very chaotic situation. He's flying around, there's explosions going up, and Obi-Wan comes to him and says, you know, take the tracking thing off and just breathe and let go and find a moment of stillness, even here amongst the chaos. You know, I think that's so wonderful that that's what you found. And I relate to it a lot as a person who I feel like I knew from a very young age what I wanted to do. And I feel very fortunate to have that, because there's a lot of people who go through a lot of their life going, I'm not sure what I'm being drawn to or what seems interesting to me, because I was a huge Star Wars fan too. I love The Karate Kid, but I think that what drew me in was I want to tell stories like whoever was responsible for telling this story, I want to do what they do. And I also like that you went and took, you know, karate lessons, which I think a lot of young kids do, but they do it because they want to be like a cool, you know, they want to be like a cool ninja or like Chuck Norris or like Jean-Claude Van Damme. And you went and you were like, I want to learn the thing about sitting on my heels and being in discomfort and learning how, like, what a lovely lesson to learn at a young age, to learn how to be still in discomfort, to be still in pain, to be still in chaos. I feel like I'm just starting to learn that, and I'm 34 years old. So what a lovely thing to come to at such a young age. What exactly do you think of when you think of people who are in entangles? What exactly do you think are the things that people get tangled up in? This is a phrase that keeps coming up, and it's obviously the title of your book. But what is that? What do you think that people are regularly tangled up in that they need to become untangled from?
Well, one of the things I love about that word is that it's actually a word that's attributed to the Buddha talking about our situation. Mm-hmm. And this was like almost 2,600 years ago. So there's something very, I guess we were talking about lineage earlier. It's something wonderful to realize, wow, this is not a new situation for humans or living beings. You know, that there we get tangled up. And the Buddha was, you know, I remember when I was around 17, it was the same summer I met my first Zen teacher. And this teacher, Jeff Kornfield, actually, I was at this retreat and he said, the whole world is tangled in a tangle. Who will untangle this tangle? And I remember thinking, me.
I love that.
And I feel like one of the things that is so powerful about the tangle is that, yeah, it is up to each of us to do it. And the key part is that it's impossible, in my experience, to do it alone. That we have to find, you know, like the kind of crew around us of, whether that's professional people, of therapists and who have been super important to me in my life, as well as teachers, you know, and Zen teachers have been, you know, cornerstones of my life, and good spiritual friends who really take the moment to say, what's your deal? You know, I remember around that same time, I was walking on some street with my friend Liz, and she turned to me and said, you know, who really gets to know you? Because inside of you, you never talk about it, there's this deep sadness
mm.
and rage, and who gets to know that? And I remember turning to her and feeling like, she sees me. And I hadn't felt seen in that kind of verticality before. And at least that people had not explicitly said it. I had other people who I could feel they saw it, but there was something about the generosity and courage of her saying, what's your deal? And I'd like to know. And so I think that in order to untangle, first of all, it's super helpful to remember that this is not new. This is not social media related. This is not, you know, streaming service related. This is life related.
Mm-hmm.
This is human being related. You know, often we have these two amazing Maine Coon cats, which are, you know, they're very large, like more than 20 pounds, like these massive beings. And yet they're quite skittish, you know, they hear sound and they're like,
yeah.
And so I think it's helpful to realize, all right, living beings of all species jump and react and kind of go back into their pattern as opposed to meeting it. So I don't know mm-hmm. if you can hear the siren right now.
Are you in New York City?
Yeah.
It sounds like New York City.
But to me, it's like an amazing sound, you know, to remember that someone is responding to a cry for help.
Yes.
And so we have like this endless opportunities here in New York City to hear. And if you can really hear it, you're like, wow, that's so amazing that someone is needing help and people are responding. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that's also part of how you untangle, is to realize, oh, I can ask for help. I can call out and say, I need help.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that's the foundation for change, is to realize that I'm hurting, I'm stuck, I'm a little lost right now. And I can do something different. So really learning how to really acknowledge, you know, one of the things that I love so much about this, you know, to me, the Buddhism is like an amazing pedagogy. It's like this amazing map of how to support oneself and others to actually be free. And so we have to acknowledge the nobility of our own suffering. Like when my friend Liz turned to me on that street, it's like, oh yeah, like I do carry this. I do carry it.
Yes.
I carry my tangle. And that was the beginning of me beginning to share it and find slowly ways to actually connect to other people in a more real and vulnerable way, which was suddenly kind of, you know, here in New York City, we have this massive, gorgeous statue of this Titan called Atlas in a place in New York City called wherever that is, Rockefeller Center. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a hero, you know, it's such a fascinating image, because Atlas is there with this gorgeous statue of him holding the world on his shoulders. And it's almost like this heroic thing, but what is a misunderstanding of the myth of Atlas, which was he was cursed to do that alone. And yes. Where, you know, in particular in contemporary society, there's like, but also even 2,600 years ago, the habit is to like put it all on your shoulders. I have to carry this alone. I have to carry my sorrow alone. I have to carry my heartache alone, my grief, all of it. And it is a curse. Atlas was cursed to do that. And it's particularly powerful because it's made out to be like, yay, look at mm-hmm. him. Look how beautiful that is. You know, what a
strong.
He's a hero.
Yeah.
Actually, he was not a hero. He was someone who actually went against his own ethics and was cursed for it. And so I think that in some ways, like that's the nobility, like to see like, oh, right, I'm really suffering. I'm really tangled up because I'm holding everything myself. And I feel like that's my job. And that's my, what's okay is for me to hold everything. And so learning how to soften our hearts and realize that like, there's a nobility in honoring, yes, I suffer and I can tell you about it. Finding someone or a group of people who we can tell about it. My friend Tarani Lodog, who is this incredible woman, and she's the director of our Contemplative Medicine Fellowship for doctors and nurse practitioners and physician assistants. And she often, as a primary care physician, she asks her folks, like, who are the five people who we can call right now who will drop everything to be here if you really need them? And what she experiences often is that people are like, maybe my sister, well, she's really busy and she's got kids. And what she's finding is that more and more people, when push comes to shove, people don't know who would really show up for them. Mm-hmm. And so she writes, she still keeps a prescription pad, even though that's a little old school. And yeah. She writes, find your five. Mm. So like learning to start with one person, how do you begin to cultivate a relationship with one person who, no matter what, would show up for you?
And it's reciprocal, obviously, because you need to cultivate that relationship. It's not just about finding a person who, you know, I need people who are just on my team. It's like, well, how do I cultivate that?
And show up for them.
And show up for them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's one thing, is like to really deal with the nobility of that is also to create the nobility of, you know, that we stay in that stuck place, that cursed place, like Atlas, because of our own greed. We're often like very tied to, and I call them giants because they are like titans, you know, to like the before the Olympians were the titans, and like they're just massive and out of control. And, you know, how we just hold on so tightly to our own suffering, to our own tangle. So like, that's the second nobility of this path, is to really appreciate, oh my goodness, like I hold on to, like I'm more comfortable in a way being hunkered down than learning how to open up and meet. And that we hold on to our resentments. You know, for many years, like I was so clear that I was a victim of all of these things. And I really held on to a resentment towards the perpetrators of that. And the reality is, it was true. I was the victim of those things. I was the victim of insane homophobic bullying, of some of the most terrifying violence of anti-Semitism, being shot at and taunted. And those were all true. But I also was holding on to a resentment about it, as opposed to like, wow, what makes someone do that? Mm-hmm. And so that's the other nobility of what causes our suffering, is the holding on to it. It's not that it's not true, but it's like, what else is true?
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. That I mean, I imagine growing up when you did as a young gay man in New York was not easy, and then also adding the other layer of marginalization of being in a Jewish family, and do you feel, and it sounds like the answer is yes, but do you feel like you found acceptance for your identity in Zen Buddhism? Like, do you feel like you found tools that allowed you to accept yourself? Or was it just this that you're talking about, understanding, trying to get inside what makes a person perpetrate the wrongs that were perpetrated on me? Is this one of the things, one of the ways that you begin to untangle the world that is your life?
Yes to all of it. You know, I think it's really, that's part of the Eightfold Path. You know, the reason why that there's different aspects to it is really that there's different ways of looking at our own ethics. And is the way I'm thinking about this loving, for example? And what I found over time is that it was not about anyone accepting me or not accepting me, but actually learning how to experience acceptance. And that how a lot of things are true. I think that very often we kind of lock in on one thing being true. Like, I was very into being a lone wolf for a long time. I like love that, you know, which is very related to Atlas. You know, it's like that John Wayne person, you know, that lone wolf, like I'm just doing my own thing. And It's a great delusion, you know. And I remember sitting on this Greyhound bus, and, you know, I was like, I think around 18, and the woman next to me on the bus, I was going out to Colorado, and she said, oh, you know, oh, you look like a Buddhist. And I had, you know, my beads on. I was like, yeah, I am a Buddhist. You know, psyched to be recognized in that way. And to realize that also I was really not paying attention to the whole thing. So she said, well, you know, so who do you study with? And I was like, oh, this person, Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and this wonderful teacher, Gaelic Rinpoche. And she's like, oh, so you're a lone wolf. And I was like, yes, yes, yes. And she said, you know, it's interesting about lone wolves is that if they're not scouting, they're sick. Because wolves are pack animals and they even mate for life. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, oh shit, you know, like I had, like my whole image, it's kind of like the Atlas image, like my image of like that being a heroic thing. I also saw the lone wolf as a heroic image. Very kind of American, mm-hmm. you know, Wild West image. But it's really, it's a false image of strength. And so it was very moving to me. And it was like the beginning of learning how to put it down and say, what else is true? Oh, maybe it's actually that I've yet to explore what it really means to belong. What it means to really connect, to be really loving, to actually take risks and doing things in new ways.
Yeah, I love that. What is the Eightfold Path? Can we talk a little bit more about that and what that encapsulates and how that relates to untangling?
Yeah. So for me, the Eightfold Path has a lot to do with first, again, recognizing that there starts with suffering, with tangle. Like I think that many of us, I know for me, like I wanted to kind of jump to like, okay, like how does it get better? When's it going to get better? Oh my goodness, I want that so much, you know? And I think we all do. We want to feel good. We want some ice cream, you know?
Like, yes.
Where's the ice cream, you know?
Yes.
And so I feel, you know, that pull is very, needs to be really reckoned with. And so that's why I love this, you know, how we get there is really like, first we have to deal with like, yes, I suffer and there's causes of suffering and there's a way out of it. Mm-hmm. And then the Eightfold Path is this these clear instructions, mostly around ethics, wisdom, and compassion, that are all about how are you, they're like different lenses of looking at your life. And the first one, right, view, or I think of view as a practice. I kind of, originally they're often talked about as write this or write that. And for me, they're all practices. And so the first one of the eight is perspective as a place of practice. And that's really about kind of taking a backward look and saying, where did I come from here? How did I, it kind of goes back to your original question of how did we get here? Mm-hmm. And it's to dive into it is to really say like, wow, how did I get to this place of overwhelm and tangled up and feeling shitty? Right?
Yeah.
And how do I really look at how can I do it differently, but through taking responsibility? So it's not about blaming anymore. And to me, many people reach this point and then feel ashamed. I can't believe I stayed in that relationship so long. I can't believe that it took me 30 years, 10 years, 1 year, whatever it is. Like people often kind of judge themselves about how much time something takes.
I've actually heard this from friends about, I'm a sober person who's gone through 12-step programs to become sober. And I've heard this from friends who are critics of the AA program that like they say it's a shame program, that it's too based on shame, that because it's very much what you're talking about taking personal accountability and taking personal responsibility for what the situation is, rather than saying, well, I drank because of all of these external factors that I was not responsible for. But I've had friends say, well, I just don't like how shame based it is. And I'm like, I guess it can be, it could be. And I like that you're talking about that it could be, mm-hmm. a conduit to shame, to go. And I know that when I was first doing it, I was very resistant to my sponsor constantly telling me, we're just focusing on what your part is in this resentment. We're not focusing on what this other person did or why they were wrong. That's not our responsibility or our focus. We're focusing on what your part is in it. And it was really hard for me because I was like, well, this other person did do something wrong. But getting to the understanding that like, it's not that we're letting that other person off the hook for their behavior or anything like that. It's that we're understanding that the only thing I can do to do my part in untangling the knot that is the world, like this teacher told you, the whole world, all of life is in this knot. Who's going to untangle it? The only thing I can do to do my part is focus on my part. I can't really be of use to untangle someone else's past and untangle someone else's knot if I'm not first taking care of myself. That sounds sort of like what you're saying there, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's so important. And I find it's actually freeing. But I think that we have to really look at, you know, our tendency to go into a shame spiral around it. Mm-hmm. And to me, part of what's helpful to do that, to not do that actually, is to really say, all right, all beings have been doing this for a long time. That's why I love like that the Buddha lived, and he was just like some guy who lived 2,600 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, people have been dealing with this for a long time, for at least 88 generations. And now I have my opportunity to take account.
Yes.
And to reflect. And so I'm just part of this enormous, long river. And we can do this because I know at least 88 generations have also done this. And so it's just now my turn to take responsibility. So I think it's kind of moving from shame into like this, what I like to call like a healthy embarrassment. It's like, oh my goodness.
I love that.
You know, it's like, oops, you know, oops. Yeah. And I'm responsible. And there's a story I love very much about that, where, which I heard as a, also as a teenager, that of this Zen story, you know, in a Zen monastery, there is the cook is one of like the most senior positions. And because it's thought to be caring for a community and thinking about their nourishment is a high evolution, which is such a beautiful teaching itself. And so we can think about how we nourish ourselves and others as like a great aspiration. And so the cook was, you know, in a Zen monastery, the meals are very formal and the monks serve each other in this like very ceremonial, gorgeous way. It's so elegant. And the cook realized that he forgot the soup. And so he rushes out before the meal and cuts some vegetables, boils the water, and puts the vegetables in the soup. And then the soup is brought out, and the abbot of the monastery puts a spoon in the soup, and on the soup spoon is a snake head. And they're vegetarian. And, mm-hmm. and he just kind of motions to the cook to come up. And the cook bows, and the teacher bows to him. The cook takes the snake head, pops it in his mouth, crunch, 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 crunch. And then they bow together, and it's done. And to me, this is such an enlivening possibility for how we can do things differently, that we can just say, yes, I did that. Yes, and I bow to that. I take responsibility and it's done. But oftentimes I experience that we try to make it not that. We try to make it something else.
Yeah, it's so heavy. Like it's so heavy so often acknowledging wrongdoing or acknowledging messing up in some way. There's so the ego, like if someone comes up and says, hey, you put meat in my dish and I don't eat meat. So that I should be able to accept that, especially if it's offered in this, I bow to you and say, there's actually something in here that I don't eat. And I see that there's no like real intentional harm that's been done here. So there's no reason for me to become defensive about it in any way. I should be able to respond. It seems so obvious, but what is it that stops us from doing that? Why can't we just simply bow to it? I've even been approaching my fear and my anxiety this way. Of I used to get so, I'd get angry when I'd get anxious. I'd be like, why are you doing this? Why is this happening? And it's not something that I'm choosing or controlling in the moment. It's just coming up. And so I'm trying to have this softer approach to it, to just see it and go, okay, there you are, bowing to the fear. But why is it that our knee-jerk response when someone offers us a correction or lets us know that we messed up in some way, even if it's completely unintentional, why is our knee-jerk response to be so defensive, do you think?
It's just, that's what we're like. You know, it's kind of like, I feel like that's a living being thing.
Yeah.
You know, I notice that our cats even do that. You know, like they do something, like they break a dish or like they knock something off a counter or whatever that is. And then they're like, whoop, and like,
yeah.
And they have this, you can feel them just like, I didn't do that. You know, who's that? You know? And so I think that there's something just about living beings that there's this habit we want to like not be in trouble.
Yeah.
And I think that I just find watching my cats seriously like to be super helpful, because they just realize, oh, right, it's not even a personal thing. It's not even necessarily a human thing. It's just a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then to me, it's like so helpful, because then I realize, how can I take that personally? And we tend to over-personalize what is just also available.
Yeah. This is a question I'm going to ask one of the as we wind down here. First of all, thank you again so much for coming and talking with me. I'm so excited for your book. It comes out on November 8th, right? So we are approaching the release date of your book, Untangled, Walking the Eightfold Path to Clarity, Courage, and Compassion. I want to ask you about loneliness a little bit. I've been working on this path and working on myself for a while now, and trying to just bit by bit, layer by layer, learn more, go deeper, be willing to expose myself to more discomfort, get more comfortable with the idea of impermanence, and tolerating the fact that, like, that, you know, looking for stability is something I need to be willing to part with, because stability is not the natural state of things. It never has been the state of my life, my, you know, all of these things. But the thing that I keep bumping up against is, even if I can come to terms with all of these concepts, this longing and this loneliness that's still in there. And maybe that's rooted in why we get afraid of being in trouble, or it's like, fundamentally, we just want to be liked so that we can have intimacy with people and closeness and know that we're taken care of in some way. You talked about the five people that people are looking for. Who are your five people? You know, maybe it's that just I want to know that I have security in that way. Is there a cure for loneliness, or is it just like everything else where you just need to come to terms with the fundamental human condition of being lonely from time to time?
It's such a wonderful question. You know, for me, it goes back to kind of careful of our prophecies, right? As mm-hmm. you know, learning how to feel lonely. Oh, I'm feeling lonely. As opposed to, I am lonely. And so, and if we feel lonely, we can say, well, I'm feeling lonely, and what else am I feeling? What else is true right now? And how do I touch what else is true? And noticing my habit of getting caught in thinking one thing is true. And I find it super refreshing to realize, just asking that question when I'm feeling something, to say, what else is true? And if loneliness becomes a thing, like as you're describing, you know, it just keeps coming up. And, you know, one question is also, is how am I attending to that? How am I taking care and really receiving that? Wow, like loneliness is really coming up for me in some big and important ways. And how do I attend and care for the part of me that's lonely? Is there a way for me to extend out a bit more and to reflect on what else is possible? What else is true? And so how do we, you know, start to find those relationships where we can say, you know, I'm feeling really lonely a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, can we hang out? I want to talk about it. And kind of think through together, you know, what's around that? You know, a friend of mine likes to do mind maps, you know, like this thing where you put like something in the middle, like loneliness, put it in the middle, and like, what's connected to that loneliness? Mm-hmm. Maybe you'll discover that you have different kinds of loneliness. Like, wow, there's moments where I don't feel like I'm really connected to the world, or, you know, a wonderful writer, Eve Ensler, V, you know, she wrote this incredible book called In the Body of the World that was kind of about her experience of having stage 4 cancer, but also really part of the healing of that book is through how she realizes how she's deeply connected to the whole world. So not just her body, but the body. And so to me, that's also part of the inquiry into loneliness, is like, wow, there's probably this often this feeling, you know, actually I write about this, it's for me the tangle of which could be loneliness is like being sealed in a cage that is the exact size of your own body.
I love that.
And I feel like that I know that in myself, that I feel like that I created a cage that even not only was it the exact size of my body, but it was my body. I had kind of like put like the seal on it so that nothing and anyone can get in. And it was about how do you unlock that? And to me, that is through the Eightfold Path of these real practices, learning how to practice, which I love because it's not about being good at it. And there's no arrival. It's just like, I'm gonna keep practicing opening when I feel shut. I mean, what could be better than that?
You know, whenever I, as I've been studying more about Buddhist philosophy and in the context of working through these things, sometimes, and maybe this is just my Western brain or maybe this is just my ego, but so, like you talked about the long river of life and understanding that people have been struggling with this, these same questions for at least 88 generations, and connecting yourself to that process and just going, now it's my turn. And sometimes, like, I find myself, I get so disappointed when I go into a book or something and I'm looking for the solution. And almost always, invariably, the solution is some form of acceptance, of just understanding that there is no, that it is the struggle against these things, that it is the struggle against loneliness or anxiety or fear or depression that actually makes them persist. It is the insistence that there must be a way to rid myself of these feelings once and for all that makes me seek refuge in drugs and alcohol or sex and love or whatever it is. And that acceptance can provide me some kind of peace, that trying to become still in the chaos, trying to become still in the pain, still in the discomfort, and accept the discomfort can offer me some kind of respite. But I become frustrated with, like, is that all there is? Is the best that I can hope for just acceptance of instability and pain? Is there joy to be found in this path, is I guess what I'm asking, Koshin, and like, where do we find the joy?
Right here. You know, joy, you know, I think that is always available. And I didn't know that when I was in my little Koshin-sized cage. It felt very far away, but I didn't realize I was the jailer and the guard. And I guess the person that taught me the most about that is my grandma Mimi. And she, right before she died, I was in a caring partnership with her as she was dying. And through in particular the last 5 years of her life. And I guess this story for me is in some ways what speaks to me from your really poignant question, which I feel very tender towards you about, you know, which feels very sweet. And I can feel the sorrow of it and the tenderness in it. And, I moved in with her into the hospice and we were sharing a bed and she was very tiny and she turned into like a little bird near the end of her life. And one night, you know, I think it was about 2 weeks before she died, she woke me up. She was like shaking me and she weighed, I don't know, like 80 pounds maybe. And it's like, you know, a little bird. And wake up, wake up. And she was crying and crying. She's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. Please forgive me. Please forgive me. And I was like, what should I forgive you for? And she said, I didn't love you fully. And I said, what do you mean by that? Because actually my experience with her is like, I'd never felt so loved by anyone.
Right.
And she said, there was this little part of my heart that pulled away because it was the whole Zen thing. I thought it was a betrayal of our family. And I really didn't like it. But it's just now that I'm starting to realize that to love you fully is to love all the things about you, even the things I don't like or understand. And so for me, like, that's what she's describing is love and joy. The joy that you can experience, like, wow, this feels shitty. And what else is true? Like, I can feel, it goes back to Sensei White, that I can be still with my pain. I can be still with my loneliness. I can be still with my heartache, with my depression, and realize that it will change. You know, and I think that the joy is not happiness, but it's the joy that you can be with things as they are. So kind of in a certain way, it's talking about what you're referring to as acceptance. Mm-hmm. What I would describe as, or as the founder of the Zen school in Japan would say, wholeheartedness. You know, I actually like that expression a bit more.
Yeah, I like that more too.
Then just like, oh, okay, I accept it. Thanks very much. You know?
Yes.
But wholeheartedness is like, yes, there's like incredible sorrow and incredible joy and incredible happiness and incredible heartache and devastation and loneliness and anger and sadness and exaltation and, you know, all of it. And to me, to be loving in this life is to love all of it. To be joyful in this life is to say, wow, this really sucks right now, and I can stay with that. It doesn't have to be shiny and happy, and as much as I love Hello Kitty, it's not all about Hello Kitty all the time. I think that often we have a perception of kind of like this, like happy person. There's so much emphasis on happiness in spiritual circles sometimes that happiness is just a fleeting feeling. But joy is like, I'm joyful that I can experience your devastation, my devastation, your celebration, my celebration, the reality of life in that kind of wholehearted reality.
Keep going, please.
I often actually, sometimes when in moments where I think of it as really challenging, I'm like, I'm in a swamp right now. Mm-hmm. And okay, Koshin, remember the whole earth. I'm not just a swamp. I'm also a beautiful prairie. I'm the mysterious ocean. I may feel like I'm just one part of the world right now, a toxic dump, you know? We definitely have those moments, but also like how to, again, that wholeheartedness to me reminds us, it reminds me of that, what else is true? How do we untangle and get clear and courageous to realize, to me, the courageous question is what else is true?
And so I love that.
In that way, we can actually be more compassionate and loving towards ourselves and others. It's a pretty good combo platter.
I'm sad. What else is true? I'm scared. What else is true? I'm uncomfortable. What else is true? I'm in physical pain. What else is true? What else is going on in my life? What else, you know, what else is there? I think that's,
yeah,
that's a really magical state to actually be able to find that and actually appreciate the other things. Yeah, that's really lovely. And a really wonderful answer to the question. So thank you. Thank you for offering that. And thank you again for your time. I really, really appreciate you taking some time out of your day to come and chat with us. again, everyone, November 8th, Untangled, Walking the Eightfold Path to Clarity, Courage, and Compassion. You can get that book by our guest, Sensei Koshin Pele Ellison. Koshin, thank you so much. Is there anything else that you'd like to let our listeners know?
Yeah, so if you want to, so as you're sharing, that that is available for pre-order now and in any time from any bookseller that you enjoy supporting. And also I have another book called Wholehearted, so that feels very connected to what we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And the subtitle of that is Slow Down, Help Out, Wake Up. And so that's also available online and through booksellers. And the Zen Center is available to anyone who wants to participate in Zen training. And also we have programs that, one is that we have a 90-day commit to sit. So for people who are interested in how do I ground myself in a practice, we have that starts in January. And we have 16 different teachers coming to give talks, and we have people participate from around the world. And that, and our Foundations in Contemplative Care, which is our 9-month training in how to bring your values and service together, as well as our Contemplative Medicine Fellowship, for, as I mentioned earlier, for physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. It's a year-long training in how to untangle and how to really pay attention to your intrapersonal, interpersonal, and clinical life. And so it's just a joy to be with you, and thank you so much. Oh, and so people can find all of that information at zencare.org, and you can also follow me on Instagram at Koshin Pele Ellison.
At Koshin Pele Ellison, zencare.org. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Have a wonderful rest of your day.
You too.
All right. That's it. Again, a huge thank you to my guest. It was an honor and a privilege to talk with him, and I hope that you enjoyed our conversation. Go check out the book if you haven't already gone and looked it up. Again, that book is called Untangled, Walking the Eightfold Path to Clarity, Courage, and Compassion, written by Sensei Koshin Pele Ellison. Yeah. Everybody feeling all right out there? I hope so. Okay? That's it. That's it for the show. Thanks for being here. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or by going to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. You can find my music on Spotify, Apple Music, patreon.com/austinarcher. That's not a place where I have a lot of music, but it is a place where you can support this show. Shout out to our Patreon patrons. We love you so much. Really, you are a huge part of this operation, and I'm just so thankful for you. Patreon.com/Austin Archer. If you feel like you would like to contribute in that way. If not, that's fine. You can just listen to the show. Maybe tell a friend about it. Subscribe to the YouTube. We got the video version of the show up on YouTube now. You can watch me and Koshin talking face to face over the internet on YouTube if you so choose. Yeah, all right. Okay, that's it. Love you. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.